Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nachtigall. I'm here actually in Oklahoma where we've just opened this amazing archaeological exhibit. It's entitled Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered, where we've collected an array of artifacts from Israel from the 10th century and brought them all into one place. This is the reason why we haven't had a podcast in some time, so thank you very much for bearing with me. I actually recorded what you're going to watch with Christopher Reams from our Jerusalem office. It's our top 10 discoveries in biblical archaeology from 2023. And I recorded this about 3 weeks ago before the opening of the exhibit this past weekend. And it got crazy, didn't have time to edit it. So now I'm doing the intro after the actual recording of the top 10 discoveries from last year. Nevertheless, they haven't changed since it's just clicking over into March right now. So I do hope that you enjoy this video. If you do like it, please go ahead to like and subscribe to our channel. And then also, if you like the content and if you like David and Solomon and the archaeological evidence backing up their existence, as the Bible describes, we do have this magazine. This is a special issue of the Let the Stone Speak magazine. It's about 140 pages and goes through all the scientific evidence that supports what we have in this exhibit. If you would like a copy of this magazine, please go to armstronginstitute.org and scroll down. You'll see a place where you can enter in your information for the magazine and get it online, or you can get it delivered to your home for absolutely nothing. It's free. Or you can write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org, and that'll make sure that you get a copy of the magazine. For now, here's Chris and I discussing our top 10 discoveries from 2023. With that said, we're going to get into our top 10. In order to do this, I have Christopher Reams from our Armstrong Institute in Jerusalem to help me go through this. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, Brent. It's good to be here. It's been a little while since we've done one of these sit-downs.
Yeah, it certainly has, and it's due course. Our last year when we did the top 10, we recorded it, I think, a week after this time, so middle February, a bit later, so we're 1 week ahead of when we did it last year. Some people's top 10, they came out even before 2023 was done, so I don't know, they weren't very hopeful for the last days of 2023. We gave it some extra time just in case some other discoveries rolled in. So what follows is our top 10 list of biblical archaeology discoveries for 2023. Some of these are in the form of individual small finds. Others are site finds. Some are the product of general research and publication as well. So they're not necessarily things that have come out of the earth in 2023, but they could be like a groundbreaking study of the biblical period that came out in 2023. So let's start with number 10, and I'll kick that to you, Chris.
Okay, so number 10, we've got the oldest known gate ever discovered in the Holy Land up till this point. This was in August, the announcement came through from Tel Irani. So Tel Irani is a site in the Judean Shfila, the lowlands just northeast of the Gaza Strip. Major site dating to the early Bronze Age 1B. So that's around about 5,500 years ago, this gatehouse or this gate complex that was discovered. So the remains were preserved to a height of about 1.5 meters and consist of large monolithic stones and also mud brick. There's a gate passageway that they found at the site, and it's flanked on both sides by two towers. So a really significant fortification system, including a gate and including a wall of a width of about 7 to 8 meters wide. So a really early, which made it newsworthy and significant, but also powerful fortress of such an early time period here, really a time period that we start to see the development of urbanization. So that's in top 10. And I think we're going to go through these top these first five pretty quickly. So I'll kick it back to you for number nine.
Yeah, number nine is the first use of a corbelled vault. And this was discovered at Tel Shimron. This is in the area between the Sea of Galilee and Haifa, Jezreel Valley, Tel Shimron. And this dates back to the Middle Bronze Age as well. So 3,800 years ago. They were excavating this tell, which they have done for several years by Daniel Master and Mario Martin. And
What was interesting is they found this really extra raised platform, if we can call it that, on top of the tell. This is a tower that stood about 5 meters tall. And in the middle of the tower is this corridor that was filled up that then go down, turned a corner, went down into a kind of a descending staircase, with the ceiling being this corbelled vault, which is kind of like a precursor to the arch. If people have been to Tel Dan in the north of Israel, they'll see the Abrahamic Gate, as it's called there, and you have this arch that's made out of mud brick, but it's an actual arch, a smooth arch, if I can call it that. This one has bricks that come and go up and up like a staggered roof. And so this was the first ever time that this has been discovered in the Levant, especially from this early. And normally you don't find these preserved. This was unfired mud brick. And so they found this preserved because the excavators believe it was made, and then pretty soon after it was backfilled. It was refilled and shortly thereafter. So it was preserved for 3,800 years. This is what Daniel Master wrote about it. Again, he was the co-director here. He said, the Tel Shimron passageway with corbelled vault is an important gap, fills an important gap in the history of architecture in this region. The vault is an ancestor to the mud brick radial arch that you see in other sites throughout Israel. So really amazing to see something of this fully preserved vaulted archway coming out of Tel Shimron in the north central of Israel. All right, Chris, number eight.
Okay, this is patriarchal period currency. So this was a study published in the Journal of Archaeological Science last year that concluded that silver pieces, or hack silver, as they're known as, were used as currency in the Levant at the time of the biblical patriarch, so during the Middle Bronze Age, so the first half of the second millennium BCE. So it was initially believed that the silver currency was more used during the Iron Age, so from about 1200 BCE onwards. So this study basically looked at silver hoards that were found in these southern Levant areas that dated much earlier. So this isn't the type of currency where you think of coins being used. These are chopped up pieces of silver at this time period that are being used. Now, some difficulty comes along when you're trying to determine, are these just pieces from a silver workshop, or are these pieces actually being used and weighed out as currency? So what the study concluded was that these hoards were in areas not associated at all with silver working, but in fact they were being gathered and used for their intrinsic value, and therefore being used properly as hack silver and weighed out as such as a form of currency. And this was kind of exciting because there's several passages in the Bible that talk about this practice of weighing out silver. And even more exciting was the location of the silver, the origin of the silver. So isotopic testing of the silver determined that it had come from the Hittite area up in Anatolia, modern-day Turkey. And then you've got the classic example in the Bible of Genesis 23 and Abraham's interactions with the Hittites, the children of Heth and Ephron the Hittite, and weighing out silver to Ephron the Hittite to buy some land from him. So it shows this kind of currency, weighed out silver, was being used at that time period, and even a connection with the Hittites there. Okay, number seven is ancient Israelite DNA. This is just a brief one, and this isn't so much of a discovery as in the potential for future discoveries. So this was the discovery of basically a rare, clean and clear First Temple period burial site, Israelite family burial at Kirjath Jearim or Kiryat Yearim, with remains of the burial preserved enough to where DNA could be extracted. So basically this is the first time that clean and clear ancient Israelite DNA has been able to be recovered. That's not to say it's never happened before, but There's always the questions, like in some of these burials, like are we sure that this is an Israelite burial versus, say, a Canaanite burial or Moabite or from some of these other surroundings? But this was a very clean and clear burial, and not only that, in many cases it can be impossible to retrieve properly preserved DNA remains. So in this case, they were able to do so, and from two members of this apparently family burial at Kirjath Jearim. So this is at least a start that researchers can use to further investigate Israelite DNA, ancient Israelite DNA, and Israelite origins. So we look forward to what comes from that. Over to you for number six, Brent.
Yeah, I'll take the next two, six and five. And six is actually two discoveries, I suppose. This was interesting because part of this discovery made the top of the top 10 list of archaeological finds for the National Geographic. So you might have actually heard this discovery of four Roman era swords that were found in this area overlooking the Dead Sea in a cave. Really interesting. Everyone likes to find gold, treasure, or weapons. And so this is the weapon category. They've been dated to the general use in Judea in the first century and a little bit thereafter. And so they assume that these were swords, Roman swords, that were taken probably by Jewish renegades that hid them because they were found in a cave quite well hidden. And then to be used in a later time in the Bar Kokhba revolt, most likely. They're not exactly sure, but nevertheless, these four well-preserved swords, incredible discovery, and this was discovered by Ariel University's Dr. Asaf Geyer and his team. They were actually there for a whole different purpose. Previously, in the early 70s, there was an excavation of this cave, or an investigation of this cave, I should say, where they discovered a Paleo-Hebrew inscription on a stalactite, or stalagmite, can't remember. Nevertheless, stalactite, okay, so they hold tight to the roof, if I recall correctly. So coming down from the ceiling, and it was partly translated back in the 70s, and it might have said God on it. It was perhaps a blessing, they believe. There's about nine lines of text, I believe, and only a couple of them were partially translated back then that looked like it mimicked a blessing in the Bible of thank you, God, for kind of preserving us in this desolate area, this wilderness. And so the original goal of this team recently was to go back and investigate that, use modern technology and see if they can find out more of this inscription. And what they did find, and more of this is going to come out, but at least they've released so far, that they have found the phrase on another line that says the Valley of Salt. And this is interesting because it's found overlooking the Valley of Salt, or part of the Valley of Salt, overlooking the Salt Sea, Yam HaMelech, as it's known in the Bible. And so here you've got a biblical use of this geographic region, a use outside the Bible, I should say, of how the Bible describes this geographic region. So you've got a biblical text that uses Valley of Salt and the way that it's spelt in particular, and it's the same in this Paleo-Hebrew inscription. So they don't have an exact date for this. I think it's sometime in the late 7th and 8th century. Do you remember, Chris?
No, I don't. Second half of the First Temple period.
Okay, yeah, so towards the end of the First Temple period, so still early, and we just don't have that many conclusive inscriptions from this period. I guess we do have a few, but we'd always like more. So so this was just an exciting discovery as well, using modern technology to try and decipher inscriptions that were known previously. So congratulations to that team on that, and we look forward to more that's going to be put out about that in the future. This next discovery, number five, is the City of David Moat and the bedrock channels that were found in the Gavati parking lot excavation. If you've been to Jerusalem and you go out the Dung Gate from the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, the Kotel, and you turn down to the left, you'll see this big excavation going on to your right. This is the Gavati excavation. It's been going on nonstop for over a decade, and they're going down, down, down. It's excavated by, right now, by the Israel Antiquities Authority and Dr. Yiftach Shalev, and then Professor Yuval Godot from Tel Aviv University. And they found, they've been excavating all different periods in this area, but they're getting down to the First Temple period, the Iron II period, and what they discovered was this huge moat that separates the Eastern Ridge. So anciently, this Eastern Ridge is where Jerusalem began. You have the city of David in the south, and as you're going towards the north, towards the Temple Mount, you have the Ophel, which is part of this Eastern Ridge. And until this moment, you didn't really have conclusive proof of what is in between the Ophel, where you have the Solomonic period structures, where we've been excavating with Dr. Eilat Mazar and now Professor Uzi Livner of Hebrew University, and then where the Palace of David excavation was done in the city of David by Dr. Eilat Mazar. What is between? And what they've discovered is there's a big ditch that is about 35 meters wide and drops about 10 meters in depth. So this is about 30-foot drop. And they're saying, well, what is this? This looks to be a moat, some type of defensive structure. It's defensive installation. It's man-made. Cuts, you can tell that the cuts are man-made. And so it's the first evidence of a clear division between the city that was inhabited, let's say, by the Jebusites and even earlier, and then to the what we would call the Solomonic expansion up the hill towards the Ophel during the middle of the 10th century. So this has the potential to really change a lot of how we understand Jerusalem's geography during the period of David and Solomon and after. Now, as far as dating goes of this discovery, the archaeologists there, they say it happened before the end of the Iron 2A is when it happened. So sometime in the early 9th century, this was already in existence. And so they assume and they write that this is just a part of this. I'll quote them, actually, because it was just interesting to see this from Tel Aviv University and also the Israel Antiquities Authority. They said that this feature, in the context of several other monumental features, such as the large stone structure or the palace, the stepstone structure, and then also the 10th century construction on the Ophel as well, they said that it, quote, is part of the same royal mindset that dramatically changed the urban landscape in the formative moments of Iron Age Jerusalem. So they might put this a little bit later, I would say, as far as their dating goes, than King Solomon's time right now. But they notice that it's part of the same concept of radically changing Jerusalem's development during this early Iron 2A, which people would put, this is Solomon, David's time period. So there's lots to come out, I think, more on this, but really interesting. We do need to go down there. Perhaps you can go down there and interview them at Givati and get a closer look for everybody about this moat that kind of separated North and South Jerusalem during the middle of the 10th century. Okay, number four, go for it.
Yeah, and well, let me just say as well that for a lot of tourists coming through and seeing the area, it's you really get a skewed view of what anciently the topography would have looked like. Like right now, the rise from the City of David up to the Ophel and Temple Mount is all pretty linear and gradual, whereas anciently we know it to have been much more rugged, and even more so now with this new discovery, The Tirupuyan Valley, where they are excavating the Givati excavation, like that valley is almost invisible now. It's been so filled up over the years. So they've been going down and down and down, and not only finding the kind of the decline down into that valley, but now also that separation, the real separation between the Ophel and the City of David. And also, if I can just say for our top five discoveries, top four really, but as you're saying with top five, these can all really connect with David and Solomon, which is really cool. I think in light of our exhibit we're putting together, a lot of extra material that we can use for our latest magazine, putting together this exhibit relating to David and Solomon. So it's sort of been a windfall year in relation to the study of David and Solomon and the Iron 2A period. And so definitely with these last four discoveries, these top four, shall we say, and even top five, although there's going to be maybe more debate about that, of course, it all relates really to the Iron 2A and the period of David and Solomon. So number four here are the core cities of David's kingdom. So this was a study put together by Professor Yosef Garfinkel of Hebrew University earlier in the year, last year. And basically, he took his findings at Kirbet Kayafa, well-known findings, or well-known site based on how tightly dated it was, in between 1020 BCE and 980, the single-use site, essentially single-use, dating squarely to this time period. And he took the dates, he took the material culture that they discovered there, the ceramics, the layout of the city, and he basically used that as a framework to compare with other regional Judean sites to see if there were any parallels, to see if some of these other more loosely dated sites, perhaps they hadn't done carbon dating at the time, or perhaps not enough of the sites were excavated properly. And he used his material from Kirbet Kayafa, which is solidly dated, to compare to these other sites and see if there was any kind of pattern. Lo and behold, he did find such a pattern, and he especially looked at the sites of Beth Shemesh, Tel en Naspa, and Kirbet Ed-Dawara. He also included Lachish, but there's some slight differences there from a later period. But in any case, from these other sites, Beth Shemesh, Ed-Dawara, and Naspa, he found identical material culture, identical layouts. So basically, these cities have a casemate wall of a Judean style with a peripheral belt of houses built into and incorporating the casemate wall. This is a very key Judean style of construction. Alongside that, a peripheral ring road inside of those houses, and then parallel material finds, parallel pottery, exactly of the type that he found at Kirbet Kayafa. And so he found that at Beth Shemesh and Naspa and Ed-Dawara, and then also a logical layout for these sites as well. So the more major sites like Beth Shemesh, Kirbet Kayafa, these were located a day's walk from Jerusalem. And then logically, you would find halfway between these slightly more minor sites, these more regional council areas, I guess you could call it. So he basically, what he put together was this picture of a core kingdom that emerged right around 1000 BCE, same time period as Kirbet Kayafa, same time period as you've got the Bible describing this Israelite kingdom emerging, or Judean-based kingdom emerging of David and Solomon. Carefully planned, carefully laid out, same material culture growing from these sites. And also in his study, he looked at Lachish. So he's got a little bias, I think, toward Lachish. That's because it's been his place of recent excavations, most recently. And he's discovered some similarities there as well, which he touched on in his paper, but also some slight changes away from some of the layout. So in particular, the wall he found at Lachish is dated to the end of the 10th century based on the carbon dating, and it is a solid wall construction as opposed to the earlier casemate walls, which he found at the other sites. And he essentially paired up the dating of the city and some of the similarities, but now some of the divergences, with the biblical account in 2 Chronicles 11, which talks about the later king Rehoboam, son of Solomon, grandson of David, fortifying the site of Lachish. So a really interesting case for a growing core kingdom of David, well laid out, well planned in geography, geographical positioning, and in material culture dated to the same period as well. Number three on our list is the Edomite garrisons of King David. So several verses talk about David's activities in Edom, in 2 Samuel 8, in the book of Chronicles, even in the Psalms. I think somewhere around Psalm 60 talk about David's acts in the territory of Edom, and his eventual construction of the series of garrisons that he put in Edom. And I'll just read this scripture here from 2 Samuel 8, verse 14. It says, "And he, David, put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom put he garrisons, and all the Edomites became servants to David." So we've got a clear biblical account here of these garrisons emerging at what would be the start of the 10th century BCE, around 1000 BCE. So there hasn't been as much public research or dialogue, shall we say, about these garrisons. But then following the outbreak of the war on October 7th, what the Israel Antiquities Authority did was they hosted a series of lectures about Israel's history to kind of inform the public and to describe this ancient history of Israel and some of the challenges facing the Kingdom of Israel anciently and the parallels that can be learned for today. And one of the speakers, one of the Israel antiquities archaeologists that spoke for these presentations was Dr. Tali Erickson-Guinney. And she gave a lecture on her area of expertise, which is on the Negev area, southern Israel area. And she spoke about these garrisons that they've been finding all throughout the southern area of Israel. And she explained that less is known about these garrisons. Not many people in general in Israel know about them. And she even said most researchers don't know about the these garrisons. And part of that is because a lot of the material that is out there is in Hebrew. And even then, there isn't that much material on these garrisons. But she said that she felt that we're in a position now where we have enough material from various garrisons to where we can be more confident about their dating, about their parallels. And essentially, they date to exactly the same time period. The early Iron IIa, around 1000 BCE, what you have are a series of garrisons, really, that can be divided up into maybe three main layouts. You've got small tower forts, which are these small squarish buildings with no entrances that people would have to go in over the top, perhaps by ladders or ropes. These tower forts are divided up into just a few rooms. Other garrison types are large casemate-style structures with a large open courtyard in the center. So you've got smaller versions of those and larger versions of those. And you have them strategically placed in all these areas, overlooking wadis, overlooking roadways, throughout the Negev area, south of the Dead Sea, deep into the land of Edom. Now, again, many of these sites haven't individually been properly investigated and researched, but those that have, and thus we can compare those that have stylistically with their identical counterparts elsewhere, they exhibit the same kind of culture. Underneath these sites, we see Midianite pottery or Korea painted ware, which dates to the end of the second millennium BCE. So it's late second millennium BCE, pottery culture underneath the structures, and then you have the time period in which the structures were built, and then the time period in which they become cancelled out, which is around the time of Shishak's invasion, or Pharaoh Shoshank's invasion at the end of the 10th century. So what you have here is this tight window of use for these sites, for the creation of these sites and the use of these sites. And at the sites that have been excavated, we're starting to get back carbon-dated remains. So you and I went to Ein Hatzeva down south, that site which was excavated more recently by Dr. Erickson-Guinney and her partner there at the site. And they found remains dating, carbon-dated, to the 10th century BCE. Then you've got another site further south, which was also carbon dated to the 10th century BCE, with exactly the same pottery as Kerbet Kayaf, or Kerbet Al-Rai, actually, in Judea, the Judean lowlands area. That's the site of Har El Dad there in the south. So you've got all these parallels with exactly the same time period as King David, where we do have carbon dates, they date to that time period, where we do have clear pottery in stratified layers. We can see that they date to the same time period as that found up north. So this incredible corroboration for what the Bible says about these garrisons emerging in the area. So I'll just finish this with a quote from Dr. Erickson Guinea. She says, quote, "From my knowledge of these places, where they're placed along the roads, the topography, I don't think that there's any doubt that we're talking about something to do with some kind of fortifications in the Negev Highlands and control of this region between Edom and the area of Judea under the United Monarchy." So that's David's Edomite garrisons. Over to you for number two.
Yeah, I would just mention, I mean, there are so many of these. I think it's over 50 of these structures. And so when the Bible draws attention to this in a couple of different places, it doesn't say he built garrisons, like he built a garrison or one or two. They are dotted everywhere over Edomite territory, which itself, the sheer number of them, I think is indicative of the biblical verse as well. So, and that just came out, like, we were very unfamiliar with these as well until Dr. Erickson Guinea gave that lecture, and we've been in contact with her since, and so we're really grateful that, you know, she kind of spilled the beans on this so that we could even include part of it in our exhibit over here as well. Number two is, you've entitled it Solomonic Gezer After All. This is a really comprehensive carbon dating study that came out this past year from Tandy, the Tandy Institute of Archaeology, several different authors, a lead author, Lindell Webster. Quite remarkable, because it wasn't just about the 10th century, but what's most interesting about Gezer, of course, and if people know biblical archaeology, Gezer is one of these big cities that features in the debate over King David and Solomon, particularly for this verse in 1 Kings 9, verse 15, which talks about Solomon raising up a levy or a group of men, manpower to go and build some royal cities, Gezer, Megiddo, Hazor, and Jerusalem. And Yigal Yadin, previously, he noticed at all three of these sites, very similar style gatehouses and corresponding fortifications as well, the famous Israelite or six-chambered gate. And so he put that together and said that, okay, well, we have the three sites Bible mentions and three almost identical gates. This is, you know, Solomonic construction. And then the excavator, William Deaver, he confirmed that dating. And then we had others that came out and said later, with the advent of low chronology, pushing all the construction of the gatehouses out of the 10th century and into the 9th century, saying that they were built by the Omri dynasty, most likely Omri Ahab from the north. And so now we've got the pushback. We've got further archaeological evidence using the hard sciences, more of carbon dating, in these the layer that, or in this case, stratum 8 at Gezer, that relates to the construction of the fortification and also the gatehouse. We've got carbon dates that confirm without a shadow of a doubt that this was built in the 10th century. And the middle to early 10th century is what they would say that had the most probability for it. And then they have stratum 7, which is the layer that is brief, is more short-lived, that even that stratum is dated to the late 10th century and from the carbon sample. So now we're separate from the pottery, because there's been debate in low chronology of the pottery types. Yes, that used to be dated to the 10th century. Now that pottery is not the 10th century, it's the 9th century. So then the carbon dates that are in the same layer as that pottery come back and they date to the 10th century. So the purpose of this study was not at all to even focus on stratum 8, although it's the most interesting for us because this is the debate. It's very comprehensive. It goes through different carbon samples that are taken throughout the different layers at Gezer. Nevertheless, I think it's really interesting that it does put to rest this debate, and it should put to rest the debate over the Gezer six-chambered gate and the date in which it should be assigned to it. Carbon dates, pottery dates, they support a 10th century. This is what the research paper said this quote. The 10th century BCE carbon 14 date for the early expansion of the Shvela, or these lowlands where Gezer is, the northern part of the lowlands where Gezer is, notably rules out an association with the northern Israelite Omri dynasty. So that's done. This was not built by Omri. If you're going to follow the science, it wasn't built by Omri. However, it's chronologically compatible with Saul, David, and or Solomon, whose text-based dating, albeit approximate, falls within the 10th century and so on. Then the Tandy excavation directors consider the most logical historical reconstruction based on the archaeological remains and carbon 14 dates is the westward expansion of a nascent or beginning Judea or Judah already in the 10th century. We can lay to rest now low chronology at Gezer. We have the gatehouse, and it was built during the 10th century, which the Bible says took place during Solomon's time.
So cool. Yeah, the conclusion for that carbon sample report was just amazing. And so it rightly vied for first place for our top 10. But instead, maybe there's a little bias that went into this. But in first place, we've got what we've termed the Queen of Sheba Sherd. So, or the Ophel Pithos inscription, to give it a slightly more bland but maybe better scientific name. So this was a discovery that we made or we found on the in the 2012 excavation with Dr. Elat Mizar. We were working with her that year, quite a big excavation at the end of that year on the Ophel, just south of the Temple Mount. And then I guess I have a little bias with this as well, because I was working right next to where it was discovered. So I saw all these pithoi pieces. So a pithos is a big storage vessel, pithoi plural. And I was seeing all these sherds coming out of the ground right next to me by the guy who was excavating there. And none of us knew at the time that this inscription was among all of these pieces. I mean, you're excavating in the dirt, and so you've got it caked in all these pieces, caked in dirt, and then they go up to the wet sifting area for cleaning. And so this inscription was only noticed at the wet sifting area, and it was only noticed by Dr. Elat Mizar herself. So she had brought in some visitors to the site to tour them around the site, and they go past the wet sifting area. And as she relayed to me, she was showing them what they were doing in wet sifting, and she sees this crate with all these pithoi pieces from down where we were excavating. And she sees this big, beautiful inscription along the rim of one of them, and she immediately knows that, okay, this is really significant. I can't let anyone know about this. This cannot get out, like, to the general public yet, to the people I'm touring, without proper study and analysis. So she put her hand actually over the inscription to hide it from the people who were visiting, and then carried on, contained her excitement enough, and then came back and we went from there with the discovery. And so at the time it was believed to have been a Canaanite or maybe Hebrew inscription, proto-alphabetic inscription, the earliest ever one that was found in Jerusalem, the earliest alphabetic inscription that was ever found. Basically, you've got these seven preserved letters just under the rim of this storage vessel, this pithos. But there was still a lot of debate and confusion about it, because several of these letters didn't really seem to match well with Canaanite or Hebrew letters from that time period, proto-alphabetic letters from that time period. And then no real good translation, of course, could be given for what it actually said. And so basically it was agreed that this was most likely a proto-Canaanite inscription, amazing in its own right, and then kind of laid to rest like that. And again, I should mention it was found in a 10th century layer, a 10th century BCE. So again, this is the time period of David and Solomon. More specifically, here up on the Ophel, we're getting into the period of Solomon and his expansion up north. So that's where things kind of laid to rest for several years, for a little over 10 years. So that is until early 2023. We have epigrapher Dr. Daniel Weinstub come along and produce a paper saying that no, this is a completely different script known as Ancient South Arabian. And this is a script that has been a bit more enigmatic and less studied over the years, but more recently there's been more work done to study the script. And we do have some examples of the script, even from the city of David, dating to, I believe, the 9th century. But basically, Dr. Weinstub came along and showed these examples of parallel letters in the ancient South Arabian script that directly matched all the letters on this inscription. Like, all the letters have a good match. And from that understanding that actually, could this be an ancient South Arabian inscription, he was then able to translate and make sense of this passage, which he proposed the following reading, that it was referring to ladanum or ladan and then a certain quantity. So this is a certain incense ingredient, ladanum, that is known from the South Arabian area. Now, where this gets especially exciting is because this is the territory of Sheba, known to scholars down at the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula, around the area of Yemen. And so here we have a pottery sherd with a script that perfectly matches this this text from ancient Sheba, which also matches with an ingredient that comes from, that is known, a known trade ingredient from this area. At a time where we read in the Bible that you've got this trade of spice from the Queen of Sheba, from her kingdom to Solomon. You've got the biblical account in 2 Kings 8, which talks about this visit of the Queen of Sheba and her bringing great quantities of spice and initiating this spice trade to Jerusalem. And it further makes sense because you've got the biblical account of incense ingredients, and that's, for example, described in the book of Exodus. Sorry, that was 1 Kings 10. I gave the wrong scripture there for the Queen of Sheba. 1 Kings 10 for the Queen of Sheba. And then you've got Exodus 30, which talks about all these ingredients for incense, and one of them has long been believed to be this very ingredient, ladanum. For temple, tabernacle and temple incense. And then you add to on top of that the fine spot of this item, which was just 50 meters from the southern wall of the Temple Mount. So in proximity, you could say, to the temple and the temple operation itself. So you have all these angles coming together really beautifully and really illustrating the biblical account of the Queen of Sheba, her journey to Jerusalem, the initiation of spice trade in the 10th century BCE with Solomon and his kingdom.
Yeah, dramatic discovery. We're happy that that Professor Weinstub, Dr. Weinstub, went and analyzed that again, and it's actually come out of the United States, this pottery shard with 10th century writing on it, and it is one of our main artifacts that we're going to have here this week as we set up this exhibit, King David and Solomon Discovered. So if you want to see that, you can definitely find your way to northern Oklahoma City, the area of Edmond, and have a tour of this amazing archaeological exhibit that we're putting together right now. Okay, so that's the top 10 for 2023. We're looking forward to the next one, another year of exciting discovery. But for now, I hope all our listeners and viewers enjoyed that. If you'd like to make sure you receive all of our discussion on YouTube about these discoveries, please do subscribe, hit the bell notifications, whatever you need to do to remind yourself to check in with the Armstrong Institute YouTube channel. We also have our daily email that we put out that's located on our Armstrong Institute website as well. Or I should say, it's not daily. Every time we have a new content on the website, we put that out. And then please do subscribe to our magazine. It goes by the same name as the podcast, Let the Stone Speak. It's available to you wherever you are in the world, absolutely free. So you can write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org. and request a copy or a subscription, or you can find that on our website as well. So thank you very much, Chris, for taking time at the end of the day there in Jerusalem to bring us the top 10.
Pleasure.
And thank you very much to all of you for listening, and we will talk to you next time.